discussion. Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to a parliamentary lecture. We're very pleased to have Ben Phillips, who's a principal research fellow at Matson, and he's going to be talking about prices these days, the cost of living in Australia. I'm Judy Hutchinson, and I'm standing in for the parliamentary librarian, and I'm one of the assistant secretaries within the parliamentary library. Ben has 15 years' experience as a professional economist and social analyst, with experience in both the private and public sectors. Ben rejoined NatSEM in 2010 to lead the Incomes, Wealth and Housing team, which provides economic modelling and analysis on a consulting and academic research basis in the fields of social policy, housing, taxation, wealth and demographic change. Ben manages NatSEM's model of the Australian Tax and Transfer System, STINMOD, which is used by the Federal Treasury and other Commonwealth departments to model the Australian Tax and Transfer System for the federal budget and policy modelling purposes. And we use it within the library and have done so for many years. Prior to rejoining NatSEM, Ben was a senior economist with the Housing Industry Association, where he was responsible for housing and economic forecasting within the economics group. Ben also played an integral role in developing housing policy and analysis for housing affordability. Ben presented widely to conferences, industry groups, and had a large media presence. Previously, Ben worked at NatSEM as a researcher for 6 years, where he developed various economic models in the field of housing, demographic profiling, school funding, and taxation policy. Ben has also worked as an economic analyst with the Australian Bureau of Statistics and an economic forecaster with the Bureau of Tourism Research and with the then Department of Industry, Science and Resources. So the way that we usually run these lectures, and Ben will be following our usual pattern, is that Ben will give a talk which will last roughly about 40, 45 minutes. He'll then take questions from the floor, which I'll field. And for the purposes of both informing Ben who you are, for a bit of context, and also for the recording, if you wouldn't mind saying who you are when you ask a question, that would be very helpful. So basically we aim to finish by about 1:30. So I'll now hand over to Ben.
Well, thank you, Judy. Thanks for the introduction there, and thank you very much for the opportunity to come along and speak today, and thank you to all of you for coming along today to listen in. So what I'll be providing today is an overview, a fairly short overview, of all of the details contained in this AMP NatSEM report, which is on, of course, prices these days, which is effectively about the cost of living in Australia. The cost of living is a topic that's held considerable interest in Australia for a good number of years. It's a topic I've had considerable interest in myself and have done a little bit of research on in the past. I think if you sort of go back to about the mid part of last decade, the interest level of cost of living really did shoot up. I think the per capita, there's a group called the per capita group, and they did a little bit of research into cost of living themselves last year, and they looked at the number of internet hits on the word cost of living. And it was virtually unheard of early part of last decade. Middle of last decade, it started to shoot up. And around 2006, 2007, it became a hot topic. I think from about the 2007 election, federal election onwards, many state elections and subsequent federal elections, cost of living has been an enormous topic. And it would seem that elections can be won or lost on this topic of cost of living. You can open up the paper and most days there'll be some sort of discussion around the cost of living. So what surprised me, though, is when I did a bit of a literature search on this, there's not actually a lot of information out there on the cost of living in terms of how well our standard of living is changing, how the economy is going in terms of this cost of living, what it actually even means. It just seems to be a bit of a buzzword, cost of living. So we thought we'd do a lot more really detailed analysis of cost of living in Australia, what that means, who's better off, who's worse off, what are the real pressure points of the cost of living analysis. I guess what we've considered, though, is we've done into a lot more detail than what you'd normally see. So you see sort of this macroeconomic picture of the consumer price index or of gross domestic product. And those sort of indicators would generally indicate that cost of living pressures probably aren't real. They're more imagined than they are real. So we've had consumer price indexes being pretty flat for a long time. Employment growth's been strong, unemployment's low, GDP's been growing consecutively for 20 or so years. So it's kind of surprising you would have at the same time all these cost of living pressure stories. It sort of indicates the economy is doing beautifully well and living standards are increasing, and on a world standard we're doing incredibly well. So we've had a look, I guess, in a lot more detail to try and figure out, well, where are these pressure points? Sorry, I thought that was working, but maybe that'll do it. So what have we looked at? We've looked at in detail the households who are better or worse off. So we've looked at sort of your high income groups, your middle income groups, your low income groups. This is a very standard sort of NatSem style analysis, looking at the distributional side of the winners and losers of this cost of living debate. We've also looked in detail at which are the prices that have gone up, which are the prices that may have gone down, what the overall picture might be. So we've got the CPI, which gives this sort of fairly flat read of inflation, but are there sort of areas where there's higher pressures than other pressures, and how does that impact on sort of your low income groups or your or sort of pensioners or other government beneficiaries? Are they impacted more by these cost of living pressures? Is that where the real cost of living pressures are? Or is it that there's other factors at play here? Is it that there's greater expectations out there? As a society, have we all increased our expectations as the economy's improved so much? What are we spending all this money on? Are we spending it all on the basics of life? Are we spending it all on electricity or on petrol prices? Or are we spending it on overseas holidays and you know, restaurant meals and the like? With the ABS survey data, the household expenditure data, there's an incredibly rich source of data there that one can really dig into and see effectively what actually is going on, as opposed to sort of what the spin is that's out there. You know, you often read in the papers or you hear on the news most nights. We've also had a look at state by state comparisons. We've also done a quick international comparison as well of where we stand. So what I'll start off with is just a quick macroeconomic perspective on effectively prices these days. So what we've got up there is a chart, the dotted line that goes across the bottom of your screen there is the ABS's CPI, so Consumer Price Index, going all the way back to, I think, the 1948, I think, is when it starts, through to the most recent reading, which at the time of the publication was, I think, December 2011. So what you'll notice there is that there's sort of been a couple of high inflationary periods in Australia. So prices, at times where prices really were increasing very strongly. The main one, which probably all of us, many of us will remember, some of us may not remember, is sort of the 70s and the 80s. So you look at sort of this section around here, you've got around about, looking at this axis on the right-hand side, around about 10% per annum per year was the sort of CPI reading that we were getting for about 20 years. A lot of that was caused by the petrol price spike back in the 1970s, the oil shortage. So this led into higher, you know, inflationary expectations, led into higher input prices for manufacturing and all parts of the economy. So that sort of means that prices are doubling about every 6 or 7 years. So I can kind of understand back then where this prices these days term comes from. You look back 7 years ago and everything's doubled. And perhaps back then, perhaps that was when cost of living pressures were actually extraordinarily high and prices were genuinely rising. The circle bit there, that's the last 20 years. And you can see there that we've had a CPI read anywhere between about 1% and 5% per year. We had the Reserve Bank became independent in the early 1990s, and they have this band of having CPI being between 2 and 3% over the economic cycle. We had a wages and incomes accord. Inflation expectations reduced, and you've had this very long period of very low inflation, really very, very stable inflation. So it's sort of surprising that you've got this CPI read all the time of not much, but at the same time you've got this cost of living pressure story. It doesn't really sort of add up. So we wanted to look into this in a lot more detail. Another way to view, I guess, the cost of living pressures is, so one side of the story is prices. The other side, of course, is incomes. If incomes are rising more quickly than prices, then sort of indicates that the cost of living story isn't is perhaps more imaginative than it is real. So the national accounts, which comes out quarterly from the ABS, what I've got up here is disposable income, not the GDP measure. The dark blue line there is disposable income. It's on a per capita or a per household in this case set of numbers. You can see there that it's increased steadily through time, and we know that GDP has increased through time. We know that in this case disposable income has increased through time. This accounts for inflation, so it's after the impact of prices. So this suggests that the Australian economy, effectively the pie has gotten bigger. It means that we're producing more, our incomes are more, we're spending more money. In this instance, our incomes are higher, and it's risen throughout time. It was particularly strong in the last decade. So you can see up there from about 2007 onwards, there's been a particularly strong push in terms of the GDP measure of income. Another way of looking at the disposable income is to look at the survey information. So one perspective is the national accounts from the ABS. Another way is to look just at their surveys, which focus purely on the household. I've got some numbers back here to 1994/95. There's a couple of years that are missing from the ABS surveys, and I've sort of filled in the dots. So it's made an annual series. And you can see there that there's been very, very strong growth. This is after inflation, by the way, so it's subtracted the impact of the Consumer Price Index. You can see there, particularly between 2003 and 2008, there's been very, very strong growth. There's been growth there of around about $400 per week beyond prices, beyond the CPI. So that's $400 extra per week in your typical Australian household family's budget that they can spend on whatever they want beyond the cost of living. So they've done really extraordinarily well. So that's sort of the aggregate picture. Now, of course, aggregate pictures can sometimes hide the detail. It might be that low-income groups or pensioner groups or families with kids, these families might actually be worse off somehow. So that's sort of the more detailed analysis that we'll look at shortly. So the next element we looked at was looking at the different components of the Consumer Price Index. So we know that the CPI is increased by 2, 3%, 4% maybe sometimes per annum. But perhaps there are certain items that have increased a lot more strongly than others have. The usual story that one hears is electricity prices or petrol prices. And this is what is most of the focus. And perhaps elections are won or lost just on these topics themselves, electricity and petrol and what's happening with those prices. We didn't really find that those are the prices that have actually increased that much. So what you're looking at up here is the average annual change between 1984 and 2011. And the ABS breaks it up into about 80 different components or expenditure classes, as they call them. We've looked at the top 10 and the bottom 10 in terms of price movement. So the bottom section there is those prices, expenditure classes that have moved the most, that have had the highest inflation. Not overly surprisingly, tobacco has increased the most out of those 80-odd expenditure classes. Main reason for that, of course, is taxation. So successive governments have increased taxation on tobacco. Then you've got a lot of services is where the inflation's really been. So you've got dental services, you've got insurance, you've got transport fares, you've got secondary education. Secondary education is mostly private education as opposed to the state system. Fresh fruit's in there. Spirits, bread. So these are sort of your top 10 items of price change. Some of them have grown, in the case of tobacco, by about 9% per year, which is extremely strong inflation given our generally low inflation environment. But of course, offsetting these is a whole range of items that have effectively gone nowhere, or in fact, in some cases, have actually gone backwards. And a lot of that's been driven by economic reform that we've had in the past 20 or so years. So the first one, probably the most obvious one, I guess, is sort of the high-tech goods. So computing items, or in the case of this minus 8.1% up here, audio-visual and computing. So what we're saying there is, say, something like a flat-screen TV. I recall a flatmate of mine about 8 or 9 years ago bought this TV about this big, flat-screen, $5,000. That same TV today would be around about $700, $800. And probably would be considered inferior technology as well. Computer prices have gone down, mobile phone call costs have gone down. Clothing and footwear items, those prices haven't changed. So in 25 years, the ticketed price for many items of clothing, or the average prices for clothing hasn't changed in 25 years. A lot of that's driven by the tariff wall coming down. Some of that's driven by high exchange rate, imports from many countries, from many Asian countries, where obviously the import prices are a lot cheaper. So there's a lot of items that have offset these items that have gone up. And it's difficult just looking at those to imagine what's the overall cost of living impact, because different family groups, different income levels, all their purchasing patterns are quite different. So the next thing we did was we wanted to look at this in a lot more detail. So the ABS, they've got the household expenditure surveys, and we did analysis of every single expenditure survey back to 1984. Within that survey, it breaks up your expenditure items into about 600 different categories. So you're given a diary over the last month, what have you spent your money on? There's also a recall period over the past, I think, 12 months, and it breaks it up into 600 different categories. So you can get a really good detailed picture of what households spend their money on, what high-income households spend their money on, low incomes, those on pensions, those on youth allowance, whatever it happens to be. You can really see what they're actually spending their money on. And you can break that up into different types of spending. The common theme you would hear is that we're spending a lot more money on the basics of life. And then after the basics of life, there's nothing left to spend your money on. But we can test that using these household expenditure surveys quite clearly. Something you've got to do, though, is you've got to break up those items into categories. Are they discretionary? Are they necessities of life? And that's actually a trickier thing to do than one might firstly imagine would be the case. The tricky bit is around the necessities of life. What was a necessity, or what's a necessity today, may not have been a necessity in 1985. For example, a mobile telephone in the late 1980s was an out-and-out luxury good. Almost nobody had them. These days, pretty much everyone's got them. You even go to third world countries and they've got plenty of mobile phones there. So these, in a sense, are kind of now necessities. So we had to break the necessities into two groups. One was your basic necessities of life. So these are things that you effectively need to survive. So these are things like, you know, food, housing or shelter, energy requirements, things that you absolutely must have. Then there's other necessities that perhaps you don't need to survive, but to keep up in a modern society, you kind of need these items. So you do need a television. So to keep up with society these days, you need to know what's on the latest programs to some extent. You need to have a computer, you need to have a mobile phone. So they're kind of necessities. We call them relative necessities. So how have the prices changed for these items? How have the expenditure patterns changed for these different items? First of all, just a quick listing there of what some of these items might be. Remember, there were 600 different categories, so it's quite a detailed process to go through this. Your basics, your rent, mortgage, basic foods. So we're able to split out the luxury foods from the non-luxury foods. Electricity, clothing, public transport. Then you've got the relative necessities. You can see up there televisions, computers, mobile phones, those sorts of items. If you didn't have them, you wouldn't die, but in modern society, you know, if you want to get ahead in this world, you do kind of need many of these items. Then there's the discretionary items, so alcohol and tobacco. We don't, arguably, one might need those items, but you don't really need them. Restaurant foods, services as well, so household services, takeaway meals, airfares, holidays. So these are things you don't necessarily need. It's basically whatever you've got left, you can spend on these things. So what do different income levels spend their money on? I was a little bit surprised. I had thought that low-income groups would have nothing left after the basics of life. It turns out they actually do. So looking at the numbers up there, we're looking here at discretionary, relative necessities and necessary spending. So Q1 is your lowest income group. So you look on the first three bars over there. You can see that on the discretionary items, low-income households spend about $1 in $3 on discretionary items. They spend about 20% on the relative necessities. So they spend a bit over 50% on items that are either discretionary or relative necessities. Spend about 47% of their dollars on the basics of life. So after the basics of life, there's about 53% left over for other things in life. So that's a bit of a surprising find that there's that much left over. And I suspect a bit of a controversial point. That's what the numbers were saying in the latest ABS household survey. Of course, you invert that for the higher income groups. So they spend about 45% on those discretionary items, and they spend about $1 in $3 on the basic necessities of life, somewhere in between for those for the income groups in between. So what would be interesting is to see these through time. I guess the expectation is that we're spending more and more on the basics of life and less on these discretionary items. It's a bit of mixed information on the necessities of life. So looking up here at the percent that we spend, different income groups, the dotted line is the average, I guess you could say, what we spend through time on those basic necessities. So back in 1984, the dotted line suggests we spent about 37% of our dollars of our expenditure on necessities. It's increased to about 38% in 2009/10. So basically, it's hardly changed. We spent a little bit less on necessities in 1993. That's a little bit of a surprise, given that that was sort of just post-recessionary times. But it's interesting to look at the different quintiles. So if you look at quintile one, so look at the very top there, you can see in 1994 they spent about 47% of their expenditure on these basic necessities of life. Today, it's about the same. Actually, there was a dip in the 80s and 90s, and it's come back up. So there has been an increase in the early part of last decade, last 7 or so years, just where the cost of living pressure story has become most severe. It has actually come down a little bit. Now, of course, there's a little bit of what statisticians will call standard errors around these numbers. So when you start going down to quintile numbers, you do get a bit of variation. So some of this is not always statistically significant. But I still think the overall picture is quite clear that overall we're not spending... The patterns haven't changed a lot in terms of the basics of life. In terms of the discretionary spend, again, it's kind of the flip side, I guess, of the basic necessities, and we don't see a huge difference through time. Around about 38% has been pretty constant through time for the average. You'll see that the highest quintile... So up here, initially in 1994, they were around the 40% mark. Now they're up to around 45%. So certainly the higher income groups have increased their discretionary spend. The lower income down the bottom there, they too have also increased overall since 1984 their discretionary spend from around 31 cents in the dollar to about 33 cents in the dollar. Now, the other group which I've left out so far is the relative necessity. So this is sort of the spending on the mobile phones, the computers, the TVs, all those sorts of items. You can see that there's this general trend downwards of these relative necessities. Now, I think the main thing that drives that is that prices have come down so much for these items. So the volume that we're spending on them has probably increased, but the actual expenditure amount, because of much lower prices, has actually come down. And that's a trend that's occurred right across all those different income groups. Just quickly on the main source of income, there's an interesting one there in terms of, there's this narrative around pensioners, around different sources of income. You can see up there that's certainly true to say pensioners spend a lot more money on the basics of life than what other groups of society do, which is probably hardly surprising. But there hasn't been much change in the past about 12 or so years. So the red line up the top there is pensioners, what they spend on the basic necessities. About 48%, and it's been unchanged now for since about 1998. The other groups have been roughly fairly stable throughout time in terms of the spend on the basics. Another group that often gets talked about is working families. So we've got here their share through time of basic necessities and what they spend on the discretionary items. Really interesting result there is that the discretionary spend of the working family, when I say working family, this is a family that's got either one or two parents who are employed, and they've also got a mortgage and they've got children as well. I don't think there's any particularly clear definition of what a working family actually is, but this is our little stab of what it would be. You can see that their discretionary spend has increased through time. So they're now spending about 41 cents in the dollar, as opposed to about 35 cents in the dollar back in 1984. Their necessities have been relatively stable at around $1 in $3. So moving on to living cost indexes, a little bit of background on that. You've got a few different measures one can use. So there's the ABS CPI version, Consumer Price Index. That's based on a fixed basket of goods. They go out, they take prices, they see how those prices compare through time, and they weight them by a weighting factor according to the expenditure surveys, which is pretty similar to what we're doing here. There's also the Living Cost Index, which is almost exactly the same. The only difference is it adds in some extra information on credit costs, and it also includes interest on the family home for mortgages and strips out a few other items from the CPI. Not a lot of difference, but it includes that mortgage component. It's probably the main difference there. Then there's something called the Cost of Living Index, which is effectively what we'd really like to have, but there's no such a thing that exists in Australia. It's virtually impossible to calculate. It's computationally very difficult to do. It would be extremely expensive for the ABS to compute such a beast. I'll try and give a simple example of why that would be. So if you went back to early last year, we had Cyclone Yasi. The price of bananas went from being about $3 or $4 a kilo up to about $15, $16 a kilogram. So in the ABS's fixed basket, it might be the weight for bananas might be 1%. You apply that price change, that inflates your CPI quite strongly. But of course, people don't actually go and buy bananas, do they? It's $15 a kilo. There's almost no bananas to be bought. So they really shouldn't be included in the basket at 1%. It should be virtually nothing. A cost of living index accounts for that. It would account for the fact you substitute to apples, to oranges, and you're probably almost as happy to do so. So there's a bit of tricky economics behind it. The data collection is almost impossible. The reality is that the CPI and the living cost index actually overstate the cost of living, because it says that when bananas go up in price, everyone still buys as many bananas. The index goes up. The reality is it doesn't. The cost of living index isn't really that way. So the ABS produces a living cost index, goes back to about 1998. It's only for a few groups. I think it's for pensioners, it's for self-funded retirees, and that's about, there's a couple of other groups now. We wanted to generalise this, bring it back into time to 1984, have it for different income groups, have it for pensioners, have it for those with a mortgage, those on a rent. So we've constructed a much more generalised version of the living cost index. We wanted to see whether this living cost index really is that different from the CPI, and how has it changed through time. So it takes into account, as I said, the mortgages and the credit costs is the main difference from the CPI. Just looking at the ABS's version, goes back to 98, I think that is. So we're comparing the Consumer Price Index to the Living Cost Index. There's not really a huge amount of difference between the two, and you wouldn't really expect that there would be, given that there's only very small conceptual differences between the two. Last 5 or so years, it has crept up a little bit higher. So you can see there has been some divergence. The top line there is the pink line, which is for the aged pensioner. It's around about, over all that time period, it's increased by about 5% more than the CPI. So the basket of, they've got a different basket of goods, I should keep in mind, I should say, for the pensioner. So when the basket that they use for the pensioner takes into account what it is that pensioners spend their money on, as opposed to this average basket that applies to the whole population. So there is some differences there. And in our analysis, we did something very similar. So we looked at the expenditure patterns of the pensioner, expenditure patterns of the low-income earner, and we created effectively living cost indexes for all those different groups. So how does the living cost index compare with the CPI? On the left-hand side over there, you can see that for all those different periods, not a lot of difference. Exactly the same in the 80s. It was a little bit, living cost index was a little bit higher during the late 80s and the 90s, and also in the noughties. In the most recent period, it's flipped around, and the living cost indexes have actually been weaker than what the CPI has been. On the right-hand side there, we actually look at the living cost index the specific living cost indexes for different income groups. I wanted to see if through time, high income earners, if their living cost index was less than what it was for the low income earners. There is this sort of story that goes that floats around that low income earners spend a lot more money on electricity, the basics of life. These are the things that have gone up in price a lot more, so you would expect their living cost index would have shot up a lot more than others. And it probably has a little bit. There's probably about a 5 percentage point difference there between the lowest income households and the bottom income households. But overall, not a lot going on there, really. So an interesting finding was what you can do is you can compare. You can look at the gains in income of each of these different income groups, and you can compare that to their living cost increases. And you can look at those at different periods of time and see, well, how is Australia as a whole? Are we better off or are we worse off? What's our standard of living change in a financial perspective? During the 80s, 84 to 88, we were quite a bit worse off. So our incomes grew by about $115 less than the cost of living did. So a main driver of that was the fact that interest rates shot up to 17%. We did have very high inflation in the 80s, so we were actually quite a bit worse off. So if there was a period where there was cost of living pressures, you could probably point towards the 1980s as a period of cost of living pressures. There's also a recession as well, of course, so incomes weren't growing all that strongly. Then as you move forward from there, we have these small gains. So in the early 1990s, in spite of a recession, we still moved ahead of those cost of living pressures or living costs. 93 to 98, $44 a week better off was the average household. 88 to 2003, $50 a week. The stunning result is 2003 to 2009, average household is $224 per week, or about $11,000 per year better off over just that period, the average household. So I think that's a fairly stunning result. It's ahead of their cost of living pressures. And this is just at the same time that we hear so much about cost of living pressures. Now, I left out the years, unfortunately. The first two columns of numbers there relate to the change in your incomes relative to living costs between 1984 and 2009. The second set relates to just the most recent years, between 2003 and 2007. And I break it up into different income groups, different sources of income, different family types. So you can see there that over the full period, 84 to 2009, low-income earners are about $93 per week better off. Over the past 6 or 7 years, they're only ahead by about $42 per week. And this contrasts with the highest group of the highest household income group, $429 per week better off over the full period, back to 1984, but a whopping $576 per week better off. So that's where your additional income inequalities come in as a story over the past 5 or 6 years. So I guess a lot of that would be to do with the mining boom. $576 per week better off your top income group, so a substantial increase. We do find that wage and salary earners are better off. We do find that business owners are better off. Those in government benefits are better off. We find that other groups, that's usually your self-funded retirees, are particularly better off. So perhaps some fairly controversial results there. When you look at your family with kids, they're better off. Basically, we couldn't find a group that wasn't better off. If there's one group there that probably has struggled, it's single parents, which is a common theme that runs through research, is that, I guess in a relative sense, they are continuing to fall behind. There we go. Another 10 minutes or so? Cool. So I guess the next question is, well, we've got all this additional money. What are we spending all that money on? And what's the big deal with cost of living pressures? What actually drives it? So we've got here, based on the ABS's Household Expenditure Survey, we've got the proportion of expenditure devoted to these different categories for three different periods. One was 1984, one is 2003/4, one is 2009/10. So it gives you an idea of expenditure patterns and how they've changed through time. So basically what we're spending our money on. Really interesting one is the very top one there is utilities. So the proportion we spend on utilities, exactly the same, no change. And it's not much, it's about 4%. So about 4% of household spending is on electricity, gas, water, main components. So yes, prices have gone up, particularly the last few years they've gone up. That may have changed slightly. If we did a household expenditure survey today, there's been very strong inflation the past two or three years. So it probably, I wouldn't be surprised at all to have seen a little bit of a change there. But there's still been very considerable price growth with utilities. But what we have seen is that households are using less. They're using less water. They're using less electricity. So there's a price effect, there's a volume effect. So beyond the utilities, which seems to be the main story that one hears in the media, where's the real change? The real change is really with discretionary items and services. So if you look towards the bottom there, we're spending more money on communications, we're spending more money on education, so that's private school education. We're spending more money on health, we're spending more money on holidays and airfares. We're spending more money on recreation, we're spending more money on personal care. So it's all services. There's a discretionary element to that. But there is a genuine cost of living pressure there as well. That's something like childcare. So with spouses now more likely to be working than what they were back in 1984, there's a need for much higher demand for childcare. The cost of that is, of course, quite high. So it's not necessarily a price issue, but it's more that our expenditure patterns have grown. So we've moved on into, I guess, a level of outsourcing. So there's a discretionary story there, and there's a services story there, and there is a genuine story there around childcare as well. So breaking it down even a little bit further, as I said before, there's about 80 expenditure classes that the ABS uses in their CPI. Broken this into, by the way, I've left off there what years that relates to. It's comparing 2003 with 2009. Three different things to think about is expenditure, volume, and price change. So expenditure is just what you spend, the dollars that come out of your wallet, come out of your bank account. Then there's a price effect, is that some of that is driven by price change, some of that is driven by volume change. So you need to mix up those two factors there. So the biggest expenditure changes was something called car parts and accessories. So I guess that's people blinging up their cars. Drive around, you see these guys, sometimes girls, with their lowered sports cars, with the mag wheels. That seems to be where that's coming from. So expenditure change of 154%. A little bit of that's price change. Most of it's just volume change. That's just people buying more stuff. Footwear for babies was another interesting one. You go into a footwear shop these days and you see these little Nike shoes about this big. I think that's what's driving that one. These aren't really areas that would describe to me as a society that's got massive cost of living pressures. You figure. Sport participation, childcare is a huge one. Now, I think childcare is becoming the big hot topic at the moment, politically. So we've had growth there in expenditure of 106%. Now, the price has come down by 11%. Now, the driver of that, of course, is the rebates. It's not that childcare is actually getting cheaper. We've had these rebates that have, over the period 03 to 09, I think if you look since then, it's been pretty inflationary since then. So it may have changed a little bit in that picture there. But you're looking at a lot of this as services. So you've got secondary education, private school education, holiday travel accommodation, restaurant meals, hair grooming, games, toys, hobbies. So there's a lot of sort of services in there and discretionary items. One of the items that have come down in terms of expenditure. So alterations and additions, carpets, other floor coverings, tools, a lot of things around the house have come down. It's a little bit of a surprise to me, to be honest. I don't entirely understand that one. Car expenditure has actually come down a little bit, but the volume has gone up a little bit. Prices have come down for cars. You've got to keep in mind, though, the ABS applies a quality adjustment factor here. So sometimes that can affect these results a little bit. Tobacco expenditure has come down in terms of volume. It's gone up slightly in terms of price. In terms of expenditure. I think a lot of what drives the expenditure drops is that we've had a lot of areas where prices have come down. So that's really been tariff reductions. It's been a high exchange rate, importation of cheap goods. So a lot of prices have come down, and a lot of those items are what you'd be seeing here. Milk as well. So milk price wars have probably come into play there. Okay, so doing a comparison of prices between a spatial price comparison, this is a fairly difficult thing to actually try and do. There's a lot of issues in terms of trying to compare the same items between states. The ABS doesn't actually formally do this. They did a research paper about 10 years ago. We based our numbers on this and uprated those or inflated those price differences by the CPI. We also looked at incomes. We tried to look then at what the standard of living comparison was between the different states, or between capital cities. So we've got Sydney here as the basis point. So it's everything for Sydney is 100%. Everything is compared to Sydney. The cost index is the blue lines you can see up there. So everything there is relative to Sydney. So you will find there that Sydney is the most expensive in terms of the basic basket of goods that the ABS provides or uses for the or compares for the prices in Sydney. Sydney's the most expensive. Beyond that, you've got the income index. The income index is that sort of red Moroni line there, and you can see that the highest incomes is of course Canberra, which is probably not that surprising. Darwin is quite high. Perth is quite high. An interesting result there, I think, is that the price comparison is not, there's not that much difference between the different capital cities between prices. The main driver or main difference is around housing. Once you take out the housing effect, in the report there's a lot more detail on this. Once you take out housing, prices are virtually exactly the same between the capital cities. I'm sure it's a different story if you went out to the regions, you went out to mining towns, there'd be a very different story out there. Again, a big driver of that, though, of course, is housing. Another thing you can look at here is standard of living. So you compare incomes with the cost of living differences. And I guess not surprisingly, ACT has got the highest standard of living by some margin over the other cities. Next is Darwin. It's a fairly polarised place, Darwin. There's actually quite a lot of high income earners in Darwin. In terms of lower standard of living, you'd be looking, I think it's Hobart and then Adelaide is the next lowest standard of living. In terms of cheapest city, I think it's Adelaide that is the cheapest city, but it's not a lot of difference between Adelaide and Hobart. So I guess the summary of that is that Canberra, WA and Darwin, so Perth, very high standards of living. Cost differences aren't all that great. Sydney's got the highest prices, mostly thanks to housing, is kind of how I'd summarise that. Adelaide's probably the cheapest place to live along with Hobart, but the income that you would receive there is significantly lower, so don't think by moving there that life's somehow going to be better in terms of the financial aspect. So starting to finish up now, international cost comparisons I think mostly are fairly meaningless. So you'll often see indexes that get... You see them up, usually they're related to news stories, international cost comparisons. Usually this puts Sydney, Melbourne as very expensive cities around the world. A lot of what's driven this recently has been the very high Australian dollar. So it's more related to international workers and tourists in terms of how expensive these relative cities are, because it's all done within the same exchange rate. So all these numbers are based around, if you've got a US dollar, how far will that drive you? But of course, we're earning Australian dollars as opposed to US dollars. So in terms of the international cost comparison, yes, Australia ranks quite highly. We are quite an expensive city. A lot of that's because of our high Australian dollar. But we all earn very high incomes. You can look at the cheaper cities which one could move to, and they're not exactly the cities that one would ever really want to move to, I don't think. But you will get cost savings if you move there. So feel free to move to Dhaka if you want. It will be quite a bit cheaper. But good luck with that. Finally, I guess fairly obvious point is that GDP per capita, so looking at Australia's standard of living, is vastly higher than most other countries of the world. So this is, I think, from the IMF, most reading at the end of 2011. You're looking at 183 countries. Australia ranks about number 12. There's also, I think it's a Human Development Index, which is provided by, it might be the OECD, I'm not quite sure on that, but it actually ranks Australia as number 2. And it's sort of like, it's a standard of living version of a GDP per capita. So it adds in other things like life expectancy and a few other elements. Australia was number 2 in that one, I think only second to Norway. So I guess the point here, what I'm saying is that, yes, our prices are quite high in Australia, but of course our incomes are exceptionally high. We're doing exceptionally well. So in terms of conclusions, I guess one can easily draw the conclusion from what I've said today that everyone in Australia is doing just fabulously. There is nothing to worry about. Forget about the cost of living story. I don't really want to make that point too strongly because there are households, there are families who are definitely struggling. There's no doubt about that. The point I'm really making is that we're improving, that things aren't necessarily getting worse. For most groups, of course, when you're doing statistics, you're mostly talking about groups. As groups, whether you're talking about low-income groups, high-income groups, pensioners, even renters, these groups are doing better through time. Their standard of living is increasing. It's not to say that people aren't struggling, but there was people struggling 10 years ago, 20 years ago as well, and I don't think it means that, that things are getting worse in this country. I think standard of living is incredibly high. In terms of what these cost of living pressures are really to do with, I don't necessarily think the report actually proves exactly what they are related to. I suspect it's more a story of its perceptions, it's about expectations. I think what it does show, though, is that it's not about prices these days. It's more something to do with something else. Perhaps it's expectations. Perhaps it's keeping up with the Joneses. It's worrying about your neighbour's got this flash new car, flash new job, whatever it happens to be. I want to have that as well. And it's almost like the richer you get, the more pressure these sort of the more pressure one gets from these expectational issues. And I guess finally, the point I would like to make is that in terms of what governments can do, I'm not entirely sure there's a lot they can do about cost of living pressures. This is mostly prices. It's a market economy. They can't necessarily influence them all that much. They're probably better off investing their time in things they can do well. That's things like health and education, social security, and looking after those at the bottom end of the spectrum. But the cost of living pressures, I'm not sure there's an enormous amount that one can do about a lot of those prices. And that's where I'll leave it. So okay. Happy to field any questions you might have.
So we've got time for a few questions. First of all, I'd like to thank you very much for explaining about bananas. I've never really understood that. So, questions from the floor. Okay.
Thanks, Ben. That was great. Luke Buckhouse from the library. First, a quick comment and then a question. I think the middle point you make is an interesting one about pressures of modern living and aspirations. And I think some of the reporting around your report kind of went to people being whingers and keeping up with the Joneses, and these were things that individuals ought to control about, their wants. But I just thought I'd make a point that this is, entire advertising industry and all sorts of other things designed to try and make us spend and want to spend, and that's an important factor that underlies a lot of these things.
Yeah.
Rather than being about individuals, just needing to get some perspective. And my question is, you showed that 47% of people on low incomes, their expenditure is on necessities and the rest is more discretionary things. Do you have a breakdown of what were the main components of the discretionary spend for people on low income?
No, I don't. But I would suggest that quite a lot of it. There would be a component that's alcohol and tobacco. You do see low-income earners do spend quite a lot more money on alcohol, tobacco. That's not something that's actually in the report. And it certainly can be, you can delve down at that level, but you do start to, and even some of these numbers, I'll quite happily admit that some of them, there's probably high standard errors on some of them. So you're starting to get a little bit too much, you know, too low a sample size to really get meaningful stuff out of that. But yeah, I don't know is the short answer. I might kind of, you know, conjectures about all I can do.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is, again, that definition of what's discretionary can be a bit elastic, and that for, say, people at the real lower end of the spectrum, they may experience these things that we're describing as discretionary as things that are part of sort of dealing with the harsh realities of life or whatever.
Yeah.
So I just think it's worth making that.
Yeah. And if any of you are interested, I'm quite happy to provide all the details in terms of, like, there's this list, and you can see what we've described as discretionary basic necessities and relative necessities. And we had discussions around the office for a couple of days on this, and you could argue till the cows come home on what's discretionary and what's a necessity. So you could, you know, there's lots of different ways you can really do that. And there's probably some items that you've got that are necessities, discretionary or necessities. Like, it could be that you buy a shirt that's, I don't know, some brand, some label that's $500 for a shirt, that clearly that's discretionary, whereas in my numbers it's going to come through as being a necessity because it's just a shirt. We don't know how much they've actually spent on an individual item, so, you know, it's stats, it's not perfect.
First lady in the back, and then
Clara Gagan from Senator Madigan's office. Our office is in regional Victoria, and I'm interested in looking at your figures focusing on capital cities, but I find a lot of the pressures in regional areas are quite different, one of them being employment. We have thousands of people who commute to Melbourne for work from Ballarat every day because there isn't work available there, so there's a whole lot of associated costs there. But the other is education, and it's not as bad in a regional centre as it is in rural centres, but a lot of kids, there are no opportunities for young people, and those very few choose to go on to tertiary studies, and those who do go on to tertiary studies have huge expenses because they usually have to move away from home. So there's a lot of families with dependent tertiary students who fall through the gap there, who are having to find money to finance their students' education because they're not independent, they don't qualify for youth allowance, etc., etc. So I think the scenario in regional areas, and, you know, statistically we're not the largest percentage of the Australian population, but it's very, very different to the experience in a major city.
Yeah. In the publication, there's nothing in there about the regional / capital city breakdown. One of the difficulties we have is that the ABS only does their prices data in a capital city basis, so it's difficult to say what's going on in the regional areas. But we can certainly use the expenditure survey data. It does break down between regions and capital cities, and you can get a sense of, you know, where the pressure points would be relative to the capital cities. And you're probably quite right.
It's just that I feel, you know, a lot of young people don't take on opportunities that are available in the city simply because, A, it's not available there, or B, the cost of taking that sort of thing up is prohibitive.
Yep.
All right,
thanks.
I was just going to ask where we can get the publication.
It's on the web.
On the web?
It's on the web. So if you go to the NATSEM website, I think it's probably on the main page, there's a couple of reports, sort of our headline reports, and I think the second one at the moment is the cost of living report. Otherwise, it's on the AMP website.
And we've probably got it in the collection too.
Good.
Google's your friend.
One more question.
Yeah. Guy Woods, Parliamentary Library. Just in terms of the whole perception about cost of living, how much do you think that might be due to volatile items like petrol prices and like interest rates? So, for instance, in the lead up to the 2007 election and shortly after 2008, when interest rates and petrol prices were going through the roof because of the lead up to the GFC, that was when I started to really notice people sort of complaining about cost of living. And also, you notice sort of a regional distribution of it as well. For instance, the RBA puts out statistics in its one of its reports that looks at housing stress, and, you know, like a measure is 90 days in arrears. And it was those areas like the western suburbs of Sydney where it was worse. So they were being hit by the double whammy. You know, that's an interesting point, because they're having to commute into the city, so petrol prices for them are going up, so they're spending much more on petrol at that period. Plus interest rates are going up as well. And in that area, a lot of them had large mortgages. So those two things were putting squeeze on those families. And that seemed to me that whenever the press talked about it, they would hone in on that. So how much of that cost of living story is actually as a result of that perception and the impact of those things on those groups?
I don't really say in the report exactly what it is there, but I guess there are certain items that are highly visible. Whether they're volatile or visible, I'm not sure, but there are items like petrol prices. So we all fill up our petrol tanks on a weekly basis or fortnightly basis. We all pay electricity bills. We all pay the mortgage. So these are sort of the obvious prices that one sees. So obviously we put all of our attention on those things, and that's what's in the paper day in, day out. We've got a carbon price coming along soon, and that will have knock-on effect, particularly to electricity prices and gas prices. But all those other prices that are coming down, they're often on things that we might only buy every couple of years. We only buy a television every, I don't know, 5 years or 3 or 4 years. We buy computers rarely. We buy cars rarely. All the things that have been coming down, a lot of the things that have been coming down, like I guess even clothes perhaps, they're not regular things you buy, and you buy different things each time. Perhaps we just don't notice them as much. They don't get recorded in our minds for whatever reason. But yeah, it does seem to be more about perceptions, and certainly there's always great media beat-up stories available for electricity prices and petrol prices. A surprising result for me was that petrol prices have risen in line with incomes since 1984. Electricity prices have done exactly the same. But of course, we base these things around the most recent experience, and the most recent experience is that electricity prices have gone up a lot. I'm not entirely convinced on the electricity story. It's like, how many of us actually know what our unit cost is for our electricity bill? We see what our dollar amount is. I'm not sure. Maybe it's just me.
All right. I think that concludes very neatly, just a little after 1:30.
Thank you.
So thank you very much, Ben. Thank you very much for being an attentive and worthwhile audience. Thank you. Thank you. I was on the drum.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. I can't find it now. I remember when it first came out.
Oh, okay. So
that was April.
It was May.
May, okay.
The launch day, I think, was May.
Okay, 2nd of May. I was in the Sydney Morning Herald. Yep. And it was Ross Gittins, I think.
So
I'm doing
the paper. I think there's a move to start doing things like that.
So I just thought, if I have some questions, may I email you?
It'll come from my
work phone.
Yep. Give me a call if you want, or email.
Yeah, great. That'd be good. I'm highly interested in this.
Oh, good.
Because I see around, I live in the middle of a fairly affluent Brisbane suburb, and a fairly poor suburb, and I'm smack bang in the middle.
What about to you?
Manly West.
Oh, okay.